You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although our founding fathers were inspired by the thinkers of the European Enlightenment, this country has gone through a number of notable cycles of anti-rationalism and anti-intellectualism. In her latest book, Susan Jacoby argues that our current age of unreason is somewhat different and a lot more insidious than the earlier outbreaks. The Age of American Unreason is published by Pantheon. I'm very pleased it has brought Susan Jacoby back to the show. Hi, it's always good to see you. Hasn't there always been an anti-intellectual strain in this country? After all, I remember from high school learning about the Know-Nothing Party.
Yes, of course. And of course, the classic work on it was done by Richard Hofstadter and published in 1963. What my intention was in The Age of American Unreason was really to pick up where Hofstadter left off. And where he left off is a pretty significant point, because he spoke in that book about all of the anti-intellectual things, tendencies that have been with us since the beginning. Religious fundamentalism, which wasn't called that until the 20th century. The flip side of our democratization of education, which meant, you know, somewhat lower standards than in countries in which only a tiny percentage of people were expected to read and write. So he often saw anti-intellectualism as a flip side of America's good impulses. And I think that's one very valid way of looking at it. What is conspicuously absent from his book is the infotainment culture in which we now live, because he couldn't have been there.
Although his book came out in 1963, yes, we were already moving in that direction.
But he pays no attention to the media in that book. And I think even if he had, it was still early days. There was television, yes, but it didn't have anything like the influence that the 24/7 infotainment culture does today. Look, remember, the American flag used to come on at 12 o'clock at night, and there was no more TV. And there were only three networks. Television was not something, and video was not something that you could occupy yourself with 24 hours a day. So I think that is obviously the biggest new anti-intellectual factor. And also, as we well know, video has not gone in the direction a lot of intellectuals hoped it would in the early 50s. They had all these visions of the wonderful educational TV that would be on every channel. And of course, there is some of that, but it's hardly the dominant force in American TV.
Well, if you watch the History Channel, you know an awful lot about World War II, but you won't know about history in general.
Right, because there was a lot of film taken during World War II. That's mainly why.
And a swastika sells. But you name a wide range of culprits. You just mentioned the mass media and then Hofstadter on religious fundamentalism, public education. But also you say junk science, fewer fair-minded public intellectuals on the right and left, and most of all, a lazy and incredulous public. So we're to blame for this problem?
Oh, I think that we the people, as the Constitution says, are absolutely to blame for this problem. And these things can't really, there's a kind of perfect storm of anti-rationalism for the last 30 years. They can't all be separated from each other. For example, fundamentalism, actually the number of fundamentalists, that is people who believe literally in interpretation of sacred books, is actually probably smaller than it was 50 years ago, certainly than it was 100 years ago. But they are more powerful politically. And more important than that, there is a bigger gap between the sum of real knowledge we have today and religious fundamentalism. In other words, if you were a fiery preacher preaching, let's say, in 1850 that medicine shouldn't interfere and sickness was God's punishment for disease, you couldn't do much harm because medicine didn't have very much to offer people anyway. Fundamentalism that is at odds with modern science, let's say, as on stem cell research, can do a lot of harm by impeding that research because those possibilities exist.
Well, America has had a number of fundamentalist waves. We had the two great awakenings of the 18th and 19th centuries, but the second great awakening, which set in motion many of the things that you decry, also was important in the abolition of slavery.
Actually, yes and no. It depended on which side of the Second Great Awakening you were on. The Second Great Awakening was a phenomenon that encompassed the entire country.
So if you were Southern Baptist...
And Southerners who participated in the Second Great Awakening. This is one of my objections to talking about religion blanketly as a force for good. In fact, most of the religious people in the North who were part of the abolitionist movement were actually, as far as Orthodox religion was concerned, were anathema. People like William Lloyd Garrison were ridden out on a rail by the regular ministers of Massachusetts. So that's something else. But what I'm saying today is that fundamentalism, literally, not religion, fundamentalism. You can be religious. I don't think we'd have any problem with anti-rationalism in public life if the world were full of Unitarians and Reformed Jews and liberal Catholics, frankly. There are a lot of religious people who can accommodate faith and modern science. But because fundamentalism, whether it's Muslim fundamentalism or Jewish fundamentalism or Christian fundamentalism, which is the big force in our country, because it depends on a literal interpretation of the Bible, cannot accommodate modern science.
It's interesting that secularization has been decried by religious leaders in Europe, but until fairly recently, some European countries like Ireland, Spain, and Italy derived the rules from the church. So we just developed in different ways?
Well, I think as far as religion is concerned, which actually doesn't play such a big part in my new book because I think it's only one factor and not the most important one, I think it's our separation of church and state which really encouraged the proliferation of religion and religiosity here. Because in all of the countries of Europe, the church and state were united, and to be opposed to the state, to break with your church was almost to break with your government, and to break with your government, the political order, was also to break with the church. Whereas here, people went spinning off into one church after another, and it didn't necessarily have anything to do with their attitude toward government. I think a much more, and also it's very easy, by the way, for left intellectuals, some of whom are pretty anti-rational themselves, to blame everything, or leftists and liberals, to blame everything on fundamentalism. But then we have this whole other huge black hole, which is our educational system. Now, two-thirds of Americans say that they don't believe in any form of evolution, even that guided by God. But only one-third of Americans believe in a literal interpretation of the Bible. So the question is that I raise in this book is how come two-thirds don't believe in evolution when there's only a religious reason for one-third? And my answer is we do a really lousy job of teaching, and probably most Americans don't know what either evolution or creationism is. A friend of mine, Steve Prothero, wrote a book called Religious Literacy, and one of the polls he cited showed that more than half of Americans don't know that Genesis is the first book of the Bible. Well, if you don't know that Genesis is the first book of the Bible, how are you going to know what the creation story really says?
My guest is Susan Jacoby, whose latest book, her eighth, is The Age of American Unreason. It's published by Pantheon. But the whole issue of evolution and Darwinism has gone back a long time as a problem in this country. We had the Scopes trial, for example. We had the fights in Pennsylvania not all that long ago, and we even had a serious presidential candidate, Mike Huckabee, who said he believes in intelligent design. I think President Bush has also suggested that he might. So this is an American approach to the alternative to the Big Bang, isn't it?
Not really. There was a time when a lot of the world didn't believe in evolution. We have bad science education. Two-thirds of Americans also cannot identify DNA as the key to heredity. There isn't any particular... Evolution is a battle because of fundamentalist desire to keep it out of the schools. But two-thirds of Americans cannot identify DNA as the key to heredity.
But aren't they teaching that in the schools?
Apparently not very well, are they? The point is that has nothing to do with religion. It has to do with a massive failure of education at the elementary and secondary school level. We are, in international assessments, we're dead last in math among developed countries of Europe and Asia. We're in science, we're only mediocre, about 14th out of 25. And yet we still think of ourselves and are told that we're number one. There's this huge gap between the reality And the reality, I think, is what we see going on in our economy and the loss of our leadership in technology and science and our image of ourselves as being the greatest.
Well, you
and also, that's scary, really.
You also talk about junk thought and junk science. Does that also grow out of poor education?
Of course, it grows out of poor education. And here's where poor education meets the media. And it may also be why people want both creationism and evolution taught in schools. There is this powerful idea of bogus objectivity, which is more powerful because everybody's getting most of their hits of news from video rather than reading anything about it, which is that truth is always equidistant from two points, that there is never any issue in which there really is a right side and a wrong side. So that, for example, I turn on television news shows over and over. There is a powerful anti-vaccination movement in this country. It is a movement largely spurred by parents who tragically have autistic children. And one of the things that has happened is that autism has risen as the number of immunizations has risen. Now, this is, again, a fundamental failure of thinking. What happens is at about age two is when the symptoms of autism are first noticed by parents. Around age two is when children are getting a lot of their shots. But there have been rigorous scientific studies showing that the rate of autism is no different in immunized and non-immunized children. But every time the TV presents something on this, there's a crying parent on one side and a cold-hearted scientist on the other saying that isn't so. And the television throws up his hands and said, well, you know, this person says this and this person says that.
Susan,
take your pick.
Susan, I am the parent of an autistic son. He is 13 years old. He got his shots at 18 months and suddenly stopped talking. I think it's quite reasonable for people who have witnessed that and have witnessed the change from 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 150 in the time when suddenly we started giving kids MMR shots with mercury in it, to make that kind of connection. There are doctors who do believe it's true. I think that there are also a lot of people who have all sorts of reasons to not believe it. I'm just not going to let you get away with that one. It was too simple. But I go along with your general premise here in this book. This is just one case where I think that there are just too many conflicting desires and people and people in medicine and in the pharmaceutical industry and in politics to just simply say that the parents are wrong.
Okay, first of all, I'm very sorry that I inadvertently touched on something which touches you so personally. But I do think, and I'll move to another analogy because I really regret this, that you've been personally touched by this. But I do think that the scientific evidence, and mercury has also long since been removed from these vaccines, so there have also been studies on that.
But that even there, the vaccine, it's been removed, but the vaccines continue to be used with the mercury until they finished up the complete amount. Anyway, it's a whole other thing, and whether some people are predisposed to be able to handle heavy metals and some are not, whether there are all sorts of genetic predispositions at play here. There's a very complicated argument. It's not a simple one.
Well, it's not. I will say this: it's not an argument that's ever presented as complicated on television.
Alas,
if you had said that it's a very complicated argument, and I've oversimplified. But what television does is it oversimplifies it, and it does this with almost every other scientific issue. It does the same thing with evolution as well. It presents the proponents of intelligent design and the opponents of intelligent design, and the implication is that they're both something that's legitimate science.
My guest is Susan Jacoby, the author of 7 previous books, most recently Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism, which was named a notable book of 2004 by the Washington Post Book World and the Times Literary Supplement. Her latest is called The Age of American Unreason. It is published by Pantheon, and we will continue our conversation after this. Later in this hour, actor David Strathairn and playwright Richard Nelson on their new play at the Public Theater called Conversations in Tusculum. And then in our second hour, Alan Cumming, now starring in Chekhov's The Seagull. And then Gabriel Byrne on his role as a therapist in the innovative HBO series In Treatment. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also heard on satellite. We're back with Susan Jacoby, whose latest book is The Age of American Unreason. It is published by Pantheon. You start the book by discussing the word folks. What does it convey as far as you're concerned?
Folks is perfectly good. It's a time-honored colloquialism, mainly in the Midwest and the South. You never heard people around New York talking too much about folks. It wasn't our vernacular. But as you well know, we hear from the President of the United States, every political candidate, every television anchor, they all address people as folks. It's become a convention now.
And John McCain says, my friends. Yeah. Is that the same thing?
I like the John McCain thing better. My friends is all right. Not always. If he were talking to his enemies, he wouldn't necessarily say my friends. But the thing about this constant use of folks is what it's really said is to imply that the politician is just one of the boys or just one of the girls. You can look up, and I did, every presidential speech before, major presidential speech before 1980, and you will never find these patronizing references to folks. And think about it. Just think about it. We here highly resolve that these folks shall not have died in vain, that this government of the folks, by the folks, and for the folks shall not perish from the earth. The majesty of that speech goes when you use the word folks. And I think this is one, there is a relationship between this kind of language, this kind of condescending language, and what we expect of people as citizens, and the almost total abdication during the past 20 years of what used to be considered an important component of presidential leadership, the need to educate people. I talk in my book about FDR, how in the late 1930s he spent so much time trying to educate an isolationist American public about its stake in the future of Europe and its stake in whether Nazism took over Europe. It took a long time. Now, of course, presidents today can't count on an audience of 75% of the people because they can all snap off to their video games or on the computer or The Biggest Loser. But I don't see any reason why a president couldn't try. Mm. One of the things I liked about...
Well, the bully pulpit has been lost, hasn't
it's,
it?
Well, it's been lost. How can you have a bully pulpit when you have presidents who can't talk well, presidents who say nuclear, presidents who would never use anything but the word folks? And moreover, there has been an almost hostility, this word the elites, which I detest, which is used, by the way, only to apply to liberal intellectuals. The right-wing intellectuals who brought us the Iraq War won't acknowledge that they are part of the elites, too. Look, there are two presidential visits to France, one by John Kennedy in 1961, another by Bush in 2002. Now, Kennedy didn't speak a word of French, but he wasn't proud of that at all. And so he used his wife, who did speak fluent French very effectively, to provide better interpreting between him and Charles de Gaulle. George Bush, on the other hand, when he has a joint press conference with Jacques Chirac in 2002, NBC's correspondent David Gregory starts to ask Chirac a question in French. Bush gets red in the face, furious, and said, "The guy memorizes four words and he plays like he's intercontinental." Just imagine, no European president would dream of attacking a European correspondent for addressing the President of the United States in English. This is, you know, we have anti-intellectualism from the top, but I've been asked by a number of interviewers, people with a kind of very left agenda. I've been asked, don't I think Bush and his administration are responsible for dumbing down the American public? I certainly don't. I think we get the government we deserve. And what we ought to be asking ourselves is why we were willing to elect a president who presents himself as a fool.
Now, the dumbing down has been going on for a while, left and right. Some people accused Dwight D. Eisenhower of being incapable of completing a complete sentence.
Oh, he was a Demosthenes compared with what we're used to
and
today.
And then during the 60s, which many people remember as a wonderful time of love and peace, despite the war in Vietnam, there was really a loss of the public discourse seemed to go down, didn't it? There was a time when we had a golden age of American literature. So many great writers who all blossomed in the 50s and into the 60s. We still have some wonderful writers, but nothing like we saw after World War II.
Well, look, of Americans under 44, half of them didn't read any book last year, according to the National Endowment for the Arts. By that, I don't mean that they didn't read Proust. I've also been accused of being a Proust fan, which I'm not. I have to admit.
I like Proust. It's fine.
I've tried very hard, but Proust is one of the classics I have not been able to get through. But half of Americans under 44 don't read any book, not a bodice ripper, not a mystery novel, nothing. No book of any kind. What does that tell you about how we're spending our time? Where the 60s, I think, you know, the 60s are a real touchstone, the late 60s and the early 70s. And the neocon intellectuals blame everything bad on the 60s. And this is when Western civilization collapsed in the universities. And the left tends to look to the 60s with rather a gloss of nostalgia. I have a little bit of a different take on that. I think that as a result of the turmoil of the 60s, first the anti-war movement, then the Black Power movement, then the feminist movement, which really seemed to get some of the old white male professors riled up, I think there was ultimately a pretty shameful settlement reached on university campuses, and both the left and the right have a lot to answer for. What they did was, how they solved, and this isn't every university, but most of them, how they solved, for instance, the problem of that African-American history was not taught at all when I was in college in the early 60s, that women's history didn't exist, that female writers scarcely existed, is they created a new ghetto. They created the Black Studies ghetto, the Women's Studies ghetto, and this made everybody happy. Why? Created a lot of new jobs, a lot of new tenured jobs for the new multicultural studies professors, and it left people like the late Alan Bloom, who does consider rock music the major dumber down of the culture, who did consider, left them free to teach their Plato just the way they always had and not acknowledge that there was ever a Black person or a woman who had a thought worth considering in history. What should have been done is that that women's studies, Black studies, should have been integrated into the core curriculum, as they have been in a few universities, but by no means the majority. And specialized courses should have been left for specialized people. When I graduated from Michigan State University in 1965, and I graduated with high honors, I had never read a word by W.E.B. Du Bois, never heard of him. And this doesn't just say that Michigan State was not a good university then. It wasn't much worse than any other state university.
But it is a state with a large Black population.
But there weren't very many Black students at Michigan State then. In fact, I can tell you how many were there. There were 600 out of a student population of 26,000 when I graduated. I was a reporter then. So it was a statistic I liked. But that's my whole point, is that Langston Hughes and W.E.B. Du Bois and John Hope Franklin are not just for Black students, but that to have those things, and female writers are not just for female students. And what we did was wrong, and greatly, greatly impoverished the intellectual fare that universities have had to offer students.
My guest is Susan Jacoby, whose latest book is The Age of American Unreason, published by Pantheon. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Frederick Cruz has called this book A Fearless Jeremiah. Do you see it as a Jeremiah?
I think it does. And by the way, Jeremiah is a word that now has to be explained if you use it, not to your audience, but that it comes from the prophet Jeremiah, and it was a kind of lamentation. I think it is something of a Jeremiah. Only in that I find it difficult to imagine the reversal of these trends. However, I have to say, I've never had a book on the bestseller list before in all of this endless string of worthy books that I've written. This book has sold more copies in 3 weeks than Freethinkers sold in 3 years. I think that there are more people out there who are concerned about this than I realized there were. And in particular, and this is hopeful, there are a number of parents of young children who are concerned. One of the most disheartening things that happened just in the time that I was writing this book is there was this great push for videos and TV, not just for toddlers, but for babies. Baby First TV is meant for children as young as 6 months. This, of course, is the last untapped video market. And I think that one of the things I hope to do is to start a cultural conversation about how we spend our time. And as you know, you can only control what children do for about the first 6 years of their lives. Afterwards, everything else comes at them, and you can no more stop them from looking at something at some other kid's house than you can stop them from eating junk food at another kid's house. But I think that, and I wouldn't be so stuffy or idiotic as to suggest that there's anything wrong with parents putting a toddler in front of a video for an hour while they have a drink and some civilized conversation. I did it with my own nieces.
Well, it used to be mobiles, and things like that.
Right.
So it's the same sort of thing.
But that's a far different thing from putting a TV screen in your baby's room or letting your toddler sit in front of a video screen for 6 hours a day. And I don't think, by the way, it's very popular among upper middle class people to say, well, as long as it's educational video, it's okay. I actually think the amount of time is more important than whatever they're watching.
Well, where do you fall in the whole debate over whether we spend just too much time alone as it is, watching television, sitting at the computer, listening to iPods?
Well, it's I fall pretty much on the side of the not I would say technophobe debate, but again, I think it's a matter of proportion. I think that certainly there are lots of components of intellectual life. Books aren't the only one. Conversation is another. Spending time with friends and talking about things is another. Conversation, if you are alone in front of a video game, you are not having a conversation. And these are all part of intellectual life. And again, it's a matter of how do I want to spend my time? It's not even, and thinking about our level of political discourse, this is part of it too. I guess one of the reasons I was so encouraged at seeing all the young people come out in the Obama campaign is it's something active. They're not just sitting and looking at clips on YouTube. And for every minute we spend with this passive stuff coming at us, we're not doing something else. Well, because one thing that hasn't changed is there's only 24 hours in a day. I wrote a piece for the Washington Post when this book came out and got a lot of emails, a lot of them with the subject line, "You're an idiot," which I occasionally opened them up. And one man said that, well, there's nothing wrong with the fact that two-thirds of Americans can't find a rock on a map. 80% of people don't know anything anyway. And they went on to say that I don't care whether my car mechanic can find a rock on a map. All I care about is that he knows how to fix the car. Well, this, to me, is the essence of elitism. I don't believe you have to be a college graduate or an intellectual, which are two different things, to know some basic things about history and geography to enjoy a book. And to say that my car mechanic doesn't have to do any of that, what could be more elitist than that? What could be more contrary to the spirit of the founders of our government?
But you say even among intellectuals and non-intellectuals alike, whether on left or right, they tend to tune out any voice that's not an echo.
Well,
we even have the phrase "ditto heads."
This is also a part of the impoverishment of our culture. When I wrote Freethinkers, I really was looking forward to lecturing, and I was invited to lecture at a lot of colleges, some of them in the Bible Belt, and just to talk to people about a part of our history that I don't feel is taught in elementary and secondary school. But what I quickly found, and serious conservatives find this too on the lecture circuit, is that 95% of my audiences, unless the professor made it a class requirement, were people who already agreed with me. This was not always so in American history. In the 19th century, which was the golden age of the lecture. I mean, Robert Ingersoll, who was known as the great agnostic, attracted crowds of tens of thousands in big cities. Now, they certainly weren't all people who agreed with his anti-religious views. They were people who wanted to hear what he had to say for themselves. And we've really lost that.
And why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's part of a, again. It's
is it polarization? The polarization everybody complains about.
That's an interesting question. Does the polarization come from the dumbing down, or does the dumbing down come from the polarization? I would argue that a lot of our political polarization does come from the dumbing down, and part of the process of dumbing down is enabled by the media. In that, although there are more choices than ever, we also have the choice for the first time of tuning in only to things we already agree with, so that people who are very conservative politically turn to Fox News, and people who are more liberal who watch cable news might turn to MSNBC. Now, and isn't it very much in line? MSNBC just got rid of its last conservative correspondent, Tucker Carlson. Well, I don't agree with Tucker Carlson, but he often had interesting things to say, and obviously they've thought that the best way to find the market niche, is what it's called, is to cater, and people on blogs do exactly the same thing.
Well, you want to hold on to your core audience.
Yeah, they go to the blogs that where they know they'll find stuff they already agree with.
We got a message from a listener, Rob from Manhattan, who says that Catholic and Presbyterian colleges accept and teach evolution. Should make that point. Although the debate does continue, the current pope has expressed concerns about evolution, whereas previous popes have said, sure, of course it's true.
First of all, Catholics and Presbyterians today are not fundamentalists. I made a specific point that I wasn't talking about religion. I was talking about fundamentalist religion. By the way, Catholics are the most likely group in the religious population to accept Darwin's theory of evolution.
So do you think that this is going to continue? Is it possible to stem the tide?
I wish we hadn't asked that. My publisher asked me for a chapter like that, too. I think.
Well, you have to end with even some thought about where the future
all right,
is going to lead us.
I think that there are two. First of all, I think that particularly within families, we have to become conscious of how we're spending our times. And parents have to stop talking about digital controls and parental controls and start leading by example. It doesn't matter if you have digital controls over what your kids go to on a computer, if you're sitting with your glazed expression at the screen 5 hours a night. Children live what they see in their homes. That I believe. And parents do have a lot of influence. Secondly, I think there really is a need for intellectuals, let's say on the center left and center right, I leave out the crazies at the extreme ends, to cooperate on something they could do, which is, for example, devise some recommendations for national standards for the teaching of history and science. There is a new organization called Common Core in Washington, which includes people with both liberal and conservative backgrounds than doing it. I think that is absolutely essential. And the refusal of intellectuals to cooperate on anything, I think, is a direct result of political polarization.
Well, I guess we can be heartened by the fact that Susan Jacoby's latest book, The Age of American Unreason, is on the bestseller lists, and it is published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
If you want to hear more from Susan Jacoby, she spoke on the show about the history of American secularism a few years ago, and we have a link posted on our show page at WNYC.org. Also, she will moderate a discussion with Alan Wolf and Michael Kazin tomorrow. That's Wednesday, April 19th at 6:30 p.m. at the General Society of Mechanics and Tradesmen at 20 West 44th Street between 5th and 6th Avenues. You can give them a call for reservations, 212-504-2945.